This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works. This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown.
Those they called idiots traces the little-known lives of people with learning disabilities from the communities of 18th century England into the 19th century asylum through to care in today's society. It's a fascinating book. It's by Simon Jarrett, and I'm delighted to say that Simon joins me live on the line now. Simon, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's a subject, I suppose, that we don't really consider. If we think of mental illness, these sorts of problems, we will immediately get a Hogarth paintings and Bedlam, and that is the depressing image that we have. What is your sort of entry point, if you like, Simon? Why is this particular subject of interest to you?
Well, I've spent a lot of my life working with people with learning disabilities, and that included working for a time in an old mental handicap hospital, as it was called. So I became very interested in how we'd ended up, how they'd ended up in places like that. And I was interested in what happened before the asylums, which was something that came in the 19th century. So in the book, what I try and do is trace what sort of lives people led before we built these big institutions in the 19th century, and were they part of the community or weren't they?
Because that must be an interesting thing. Because is there documentation of people who are a little bit different, who have different skills, rather than sort of are they noted in parishes? I mean, how do you get the information to that without going to the immediate, as I said before, the Hogarthian image, as it were?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting. It's an interesting question that, because a lot of people said to me, "Well, how on earth are you going to find this out?" Because these are people who didn't read or write. I mean, we're talking specifically about people with what we call today learning disabilities, rather than mental illness or anything like that. Sort of lifelong impairment. And unless they're in institutions, how can you find out anything about them? And the interesting thing is that in the 18th century, they weren't in institutions. So what I did was I just looked in everyday life and thought, is there any evidence? Is there any trace of them being there? So I looked in quite unusual sources like joke books, slang directories, novels, diaries. And also, as you say, I looked at caricatures and Hogarth paintings from the time to try and track down the sort of lives that these people led.
Because the interesting thing is we're talking about the 18th and the 19th century. There's a huge change in society at this point. You go from, which is basically a rural agricultural society around villages. And I know this is going to be a very broad stroke, and I'm not trying to denigrate, but there would always be in the village, they would refer to them as perhaps as the village, the village fool. And again, it's a broad stroke, so please don't, people don't take this the wrong way. But then we get into whole communities moving into, Leeds, Manchester, the great industrial towns. And presumably people who are different would be documented and would be cared for, presumably by their families themselves.
Yes. I mean, what happened before that time was that there was a bit of a myth about that people were very badly treated, that they were locked up in cellars or attics, or they were, the village idiot. A lot of this language is terrible, but it's the language that was used, sitting on walls, having stones thrown at them and things like that. What I found was that actually people were much more integrated than that. They were part of their families. They were part of their communities. They were seen as different, but they were very much part of local life, because because even in the big cities like London, you had these small parishes that people lived in, and everybody knew them. One of the sources I looked at was Old Bailey trials, and you got a lot of people who were described as idiots who were in for offences like pickpocketing or shoplifting, for which you could be hung, of course, at that time. What was really interesting was that we saw loads of people coming into court on their behalf, members of the family, members of the neighbourhood, even people from their workplaces where they worked, pleading on their behalf and saying, please don't hang them. We know he's done something stupid, but we'll make sure he doesn't do it again because he's a good lad. Mm. He's an idiot, he's a good lad, and he's reliable. So it was a very interesting picture of integration, really, far more than we might have thought there was at that time.
The thing that must be interesting as well is I'm trying to think if you are a judge in this situation, if you are, or if you're an arresting officer, because obviously now we know more, thankfully, we have a more of an understanding, quote unquote, of the different types of, but back in this time, presumably, if you are a little different, this is seen as something that the Lord has bestowed upon you, and you can have that as a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, are they taking into that into account? I mean, the understanding of these particular aspects.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And there was this idea at this time that you were who you were and, you know, God had made you like that. So in a sense, you were much more accepted at that time for who you were than you might even be today. And what was also interesting was that you might have be described this terrible word idiot, which was much more of a neutral word at the time, actually. But people would always qualify it and they'd say, yeah, he's an idiot, but he's a hard worker. I've known his family since he was little and this and that. So they tended not to put people in a box quite as much as we do today, actually. And in these court cases in particular, the judges, and there were no lawyers at that time. So it was between the defendant and the judge and the jury. And 19 times out of 20, the person would be acquitted. Even if they knew they'd done the crime, and they say, okay, stay out of trouble. And they'd say to the families and the neighborhood, keep him out of trouble, keep her out of trouble. And that was how it went. But then there was this massive change in the 19th century when everyone was herded into institutions.
You see, that's really interesting because even in the 20th / 21st century, I'm based in southern Spain. It's once you get away from the flesh pots of the Costa del Sol, it's a rural community. And there isn't a social caste system when it comes to something like this, as there is in the UK. And so people who do have a special set of skills are a little bit different. They are cared for in the family and they're not locked away in attics as we thought. They just, you know, this is so-and-so, he's my cousin, and, you know, he likes to do this, that, or the other. So please, we tend to think that people who are different are a lot. It is horrendous. I was going to say Dickensian. That perhaps is the key to it. But previous to this, they were appreciated that they were just that little bit different. And then we get the industrialized society, and it is seen as that. That's perhaps when the great Victorian philanthropists say, okay, well, we have to do something, and we'll do it this way, misguided as it is.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I actually think that these small local communities are really good at adaptation and being flexible about whoever happens to be in that community, partly because they have to be. You know, they're independent, often quite isolated communities. So when they look at people, they're not thinking, how can we get rid of them? They're thinking, how can we make them fit in? So I think we can actually learn a lot from how small local communities in different countries deal with disability and difference. I think what happened in the 19th century was there was a big political change, and there was a lot of fear in Britain after the French Revolution that the same would happen over here and the natural order of things would be changed. And so anybody who was a bit different, who stood out, who didn't fit into their idea of what a responsible citizen should be like, suddenly became quite suspicious and they didn't want to have them as part of the community. And this happened on the left as well, because the left, who supported the French Revolution, the progressives, they wanted a perfect society in which there was no illness, no disability, anything else. So from both sides of the political spectrum, really, these people came under pressure. And they became increasingly unwanted in society. And so this is why they end up building these huge buildings outside cities in the middle of nowhere and herding tens of thousands of people into them.
And the thing is, this is supposed to be the age of the rights of man and the age of enlightenment and the great discoveries. And we have, you know, this Darwin, this Freud. We're supposed to be getting more of an idea of our place in the world. And yet people are building these institutions on the edge of towns.
Yeah, and these people didn't fit into those ideals. You know, they were a bit of an uncomfortable reminder that people aren't perfect, that people are different, not everyone lives up to the standards you want them to live at. So they became a bit of an embarrassment also, almost, and were sort of moved out for that reason and didn't come back out again until the 1980s, 1990s, you know, as the institutions started to close.
Was it purely a question of just, you know, throwing people in these places? And then just sort of forgetting about them? Was that, did you find someone, did you have any correspondence within the institutions? Did they write to the family? I mean, were there progress reports, or was it a case of, we will take them off you and we're doing the best thing, if you like? That obviously wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, it was mixed. There were very differing standards. Some places were dreadful and, you know, had a history of abusive treatment of people. Others were more enlightened and did encourage visits and so on. So you could end up in a reasonably good place, but it's a bit like the old joke, you know, how do I get there? And say, well, if you're going there, I wouldn't start here. You know, they were just the wrong places for people to be. So you could have better versions of them where people could lead happier lives. But basically the message was, you don't fit in society, you go here and you spend the rest of your life here, in this sort of parallel world that we've created. And even as late as the 1960s, 70s, even the 80s in Britain, if parents had a what was called a mentally handicapped child at the time, they would often be told, put them in an institution, forget you ever had them, and try and have another baby.
I mean, here we are in the 21st century looking at that, and it makes the blood run cold. And women, of course, if you were a young woman, if you had a child, if you were trying to get, you know, to grips with the world anyway, at the best of times, did you find there's a preponderance of young women, women who've given birth, you know, out of wedlock, which obviously was a huge taboo? Were women going to be more susceptible of being placed, taken away, if you like, and kept under helpful observation?
Yeah, there was definitely an element of that, so that if you didn't conform to society's norms, you were seen as having something wrong with you. And also, of course, you know, these institutions have been described as convenient places for inconvenient people. So if you were a servant and the master had made you pregnant and it was a difficult situation, you could end up there, whether you had a disability or an illness or not. If you were even sort of unconventional, or you were a criminal, or you engaged in criminal behaviour, the same could happen. People went in for all sorts of reasons. People who were deaf were put into these institutions because it was assumed that because they were deaf, they were mentally impaired as well. So it was wrong for them, but it was also wrong for everybody else, you know. So this wasn't a good period of history at all.
Did you find that race came into it? Because I people are saying, oh, he's going to go all woke on us now. But, I mean, there are people of... this is an empire time, so there are people from all over the empire ending up in the UK. So if you are from India, if you're from Ireland, I suppose, if you're of African heritage, then were you susceptible as well to be placed in there because, quote unquote, people wouldn't get you?
Well, if you go back into the 19th century, it's quite difficult to track that down. There was a period of about 15 to 20 years when they took photographs of everybody. So we have seen that there were a number of black people, some Asian people in the asylums, but otherwise you couldn't always tell from names. And if it wasn't mentioned in the notes, you know, you couldn't always tell. There was definitely a thing that happened in the 20th century when society was racially mixed before then, but it became more racially mixed. There was a particular problem in the 1960s when young black kids in school were often identified as having special needs because they presented differently to white kids. So lots of them ended up in special education and then in learning disability services when they didn't have that at all. And the similar problems which persist, I think, where mental illness can be overdiagnosed in non-white populations because of different behaviours. So there's always been a bit of a racial element, and there was a particularly scandalous explanation of disability, which was put forward by John Langdon Down, who's the person we named Down syndrome afterwards, who the Victorians had some very hair-raising racial theories, and he believed that people with disabilities were descended from ancient ethnic groups and races, and they were throwbacks, if you like, to that time, and that was why they presented as having disabilities. It was a completely crazy theory, and that was he called Down, what we call Down syndrome today, Mongolian imbecility.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm a child of the 60s, so in the 70s that was still acceptable. To be used. It's not all. I mean, it's all. There's some horrendous stuff in there, but you also nothing is in a vacuum. And you talk about jokes being made, although they're not to be repeated amongst people, like I'm saying. But also there's that thing. In the art world, in the theatre world, I mean, did you see that mirroring the relationship or the approach to people with disabilities?
Yeah, it was interesting. In the 18th century, there is this picture of integration, and there was a theory that your facial appearance mirrored your internal self. So people thought that so-called idiots or imbeciles had a particular look and a particular size of nose and lips and all the rest of it. So you can locate this in the caricatures and the art of the 18th century. What's fascinating for me about that is that it just shows people living very integrated lives, often as servants, not as fools, but just as actual servants in rich people's houses. And there's a particular Hogarth painting which has the so-called idiot servant in it, and a lot of the caricatures. Once you start recognizing these people, you see them, and it just shows how much they were part of everyday life. In the 19th century, the caricatures became much more grotesque and much either grotesque or pitiful. So there were these attitudes of either that people were very scary or they were people to be pitied. And you get that comes up a lot in Dickens novels as well, a lot of characters like that.
But that marries the whole Victorian theory of, we can help, something must be done, and it's the, yes, it's the Janus faced Victorian world. On one hand, they're making great strides and the morality and the empire and the whole thing. And on the other, the dark side is so dark, that it's quite scary, with what's going on.
Very much. And, one of the things I learned writing this book was that pity is a terrible thing. I mean, who wants to be pitied? it's a horrible thing to be on the end of pity, and it often comes from good intentions from people, but it does make you an outsider if you're somebody that's pitied by people. So there were these two things, that there was the these are terrible people who will corrupt the race and bring down society because of their feeble brains, but also these poor people, we need to lock them away and be kind to them, but forget they ever existed.
The thing is with pity, if you pity somebody, you are therefore assuming that you yourself are without fault. And it's a terribly condescending. It's like, don't pity me, work with people, find a solution, but don't go, what a terrible thing. Just lock them away and shall we have some tea now? Let's talk about India. That is the problem. That is the problem with a lot of these intentions. Was it particularly, a particularly hard sort of read and to write it somewhere? Or were there some lighter or perhaps more inspiring moments as you did the research?
No, I loved doing this research and being involved in the book. And you mentioned the jokes earlier. So I read all these terrible 18th century joke books. They loved them. They were bestsellers in the 18th century. And the jokes were awful, you know, but not always unkind. You know, they were just bad puns and things like that. And again, what it told me, it was a bit like the art. You had lots of jokes which featured idiots or slightly comic characters who didn't quite understand what was going on and things. But what that told me was that they were there. You know, you don't joke about people who aren't there. And they actually disappear from joke books in the 19th century. You know, there's a big change in humour. So I love doing the joke books. It's great writing about as the asylums closed down and care in the community came about and people knew about. We have had massive changes for the better. It's not a pessimistic book, although I do flag up some of the problems we still face.
What are you hoping that people are going to learn or discover from those they called idiots?
Sorry, could you just say
that? What are you hoping that people will learn or discover or take from the book?
Yeah. I think what I've tried to do is portray people as people who have lives, okay, not seen as people who are just so remote from the rest of us that they need to be locked away from us, and that, you know, people are part of families. Families have always loved and looked after these people. Neighbourhoods have been kind, you know, about involving people in local communities and even workplaces. And I'd just like people to, I suppose, do what people in the 18th century did and say, well, he's got a learning disability or she's got a learning disability, but also what they can do is this or that or that, and they're great and they're funny and they're nice or they're this or that. And not just put people in the learning disability box and think there's nothing more to them.
Because that's one of the most important things. You may have a learning disability. There may be something that people would say, okay, they've got this, that or the other, but it shouldn't define that person to the exclusion of everything else.
Absolutely not. And, you know, I've known masses of people with learning disabilities through my life. I'm actually chair of a dance company in London that involves very talented dancers with learning disabilities, a dance company called Coralie. And we have the most brilliant, expressive, talented young people in that company. And what delights me is that these talents are now able to come out and not be hidden.
The book is called Those They Called Idiots. It's by Simon Jarrett, who we're talking to today. Simon, is there a website for Coralie? Because I didn't know you did that. That sounds absolutely. Is there social media or for Coralie? Do you do?
Yeah, if you just search Coralie Dance Company, it's spelled Corali.
Yeah, doing that now. And you're on LinkedIn, I believe.
I'm not.
We can find you on LinkedIn, or where's the best place to contact you?
I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm very sorry, I haven't got my LinkedIn address. But if you look me up, Simon Jarrett, there's probably a few, but you'll work out which one is me.
Absolutely, and also, listeners, you can also order the book via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Those They Called Idiots: The Idea of the Disabled Mind from 1700 to the Present Day. It's by Simon Jarrett. Simon, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Nice to talk to you.